scientist at FFI, which most of you probably heard of. And we're doing some research that Roger here also is interested in. And I'm doing my PhD at Gjøvik now, so I'm looking mostly into the same kind of technology that Roger is. And he's working on anonymity systems. I can say that here, Roger, right?
Yes.
Yes. And he will introduce who he's working for and what he has been doing for the last 2 or 3 years now, and the network that he has built with help of lots of others on the internet. So,
you should keep talking for another hour. 45 seconds or so.
Okay, well, I know that you're going to explain what the US military and the EFF have in common, so you can start by telling the people.
That's true. Who needs slides? Okay. So you guys are... Oh, I'm being videotaped. Okay. So you guys are familiar with cryptography and network security, stuff like that? You're Unix geeks, so I assume yes. Okay. Have you heard of the Freedom Network from Zero Knowledge Systems? Okay, great. So what I'm working on is a network that lets you go to websites anonymously. So you don't know, so the website doesn't know where you're coming from, and somebody looking at you doesn't know where you're going to. And I'll have slides here. Oh, you know, sometime. Unless I don't. Well, we'll find that out in a bit. Yes. Oh, my laptop's missing. Okay. Give me 2 minutes, and then I'll have slides, and everything will work perfectly. I think. So can you guys tell me while I'm waiting a little bit more about you so I can tailor what I say to something that makes more sense to you?
You are in the location where the Norwegian Unix User Group have a monthly meeting, and we are mostly Unix administrators, but some developers as well, free software people and open standards people. So I guess a lot of new faces here, so I don't know if it fits the description, but that's probably the target audience.
Okay.
Wow. Okay. There we go.
After we are done here, I'm sure we'll go somewhere to cool down the hot emotions your presentations have provoked. We have a regular bar we go to after the presentations.
Okay, sounds good. This should be 45 minutes or an hour or something, and I've got net, so that'll work even better. Okay, so the big picture, and I'll have slides up here in a bit, is... Yeah, well, I need to actually get the slides up first, and then we will be all set. Are you guys Linux people or BSD people?
Both. And Solaris people, and yeah, I guess whatever Unix you can name and a few Windows people.
How do you have Windows people? Unix users group, I guess.
I guess they are attracted to skilled people. I don't know.
That's a good answer. Yes. Okay, so the big picture here is we've got on the internet, you all know how IP works. Every IP packet has destination and source listed in it. And so the anybody can look at it and know that this is where the packet's going. You can look at all the packets if you're an ISP, if you're a router, if you're a website, whatever, and know exactly what you're looking at. And then you can do traffic analysis and coordinate from there. Okay, so back to the beginning. So I'm going to give you an overview of lots of things. You guys should interrupt me whenever I say something you disagree with or want to know more about, because there are only 10 or so of you, and we can talk about whatever you want to talk about also. I'm going to try to cover a couple of myths that a lot of people think, such as this stuff is only for privacy nuts, and you're helping criminals, why are you trying to destroy the world? Then give you a little bit of an overview of how the system works and what you can build with it, and things that have happened once we've deployed it, and some technical issues that we need to deal with. Okay, so encryption doesn't help the fact that all of your IP packets have source and destination in them. A lot of large companies say, well, we'll just use a VPN, we'll just encrypt everything and then we'll be safe. But in fact, they're revealing a lot more information than they would like to. So who needs this stuff? You hear in many situations in this sort of context, you hear about journalists and political dissidents and whistleblowers. If you work at McDonald's and you want to publish a movie about the atrocities you found at the McDonald's boneless chicken farms, then you want to be able to give that in a way that doesn't get you fired afterwards. So another example is, I have cancer or diabetes or some other disease or socially questionable issue, and I want to look at it on the website while I'm at work without my boss saying, hey, wait a minute, his healthcare costs are going to go up a lot next year. I better fire him now before that happens. So those we all hear about all the time. Those are good uses of anonymity. When I'm talking to people like you, I say I'm working on anonymity systems. When I'm talking to my grandparents, I'm working on privacy systems. When I'm talking to corporations like Google and Walmart and so on, I'm working on security systems. They do not understand privacy or anonymity, and they're pretty sure they don't want them. And then when I talk to the government, I'm not working on anonymity because to them anonymity is scary and something they don't understand very well. I work on traffic analysis resistant communication networks. So it took a little while to figure out how to phrase things so that they would realize that that's the thing they're looking for. And they all have to use the same network so that they can all blend with each other and get the security they're looking for. So, an example, law enforcement, they want this stuff for anonymous tips. They want to be able to go to a website without having .mil or .gov show up in the web logs, because that means there's been an official visit from the police and they just want to be able to see what's going on with the website. Corporations care about the data that comes out of their network. What websites are they looking at? How often are they investigating new things on the internet? An example is, you've got your lawyers over in this part of the world and your tech people in this part of the world, and any ISP in the middle can look at the traffic and say, oh, they're talking to their patent lawyers a lot today. I wonder if they're about to patent something. The example of this, the original example of this was the Pentagon and pizza, where if you watch the pizza places around the Pentagon, then you know what new, you know that there's going to be some interesting announcement the next day. You don't know what it is, but you know that, you know, you can pay attention to it from the pizza places. The Pentagon has solved this by putting the pizza places inside the Pentagon now. So that particular channel is gone, but there are probably plenty more. Okay, corporations also, they call it competitive analysis. They want to look at the competition's website without having people know that they're doing it. And it's more than that now. I just heard recently from a company that when they look at a competitor's website, they get a different web page because they have specifically said, well, when they look at us, give them that page. And so they want to use Tor not to be private or anonymous, but just to become on neutral ground, on the same ground as everybody else is on the internet, so they can look at things. I was doing this demo a little while ago at the new police, and we brought up Google as it was from one of the Tor servers, and it was one of the Tor servers running at the US in a big university. And so Google had in the middle, would you like to come work for us? And they only show that on Google in specific situations like Harvard or MIT or CMU. So that was an interesting example there. Okay, you guys probably already know about this from your perspective. You have lots of data being collected about you. Every time you go to a new website, every time you go to Amazon and say, hey, tell me more about these books or those books, or all the different places you might go, DoubleClick collects information on you. There are all sorts of new versions of DoubleClick coming out every day. So as a simple example, let's imagine you look at car racing books at Amazon this year, and imagine in 3 years you try to get car insurance. and your insurance company says, do you like to race cars? And you say no. And they say, well, what about those books you looked at on Amazon 3 years ago? Is that a far-fetched example? I don't know. But they're collecting all of this information, more and more information every day. And who knows what they can do when they put it all together. So that's the motivation behind this. We want to provide technology so people can decide for themselves how much information they want to leak and what sort of information they want to put into the databases. Who else needs anonymity? The government needs anonymity. They don't call it competitive analysis. They call it open source intelligence gathering. That means going to websites and reading stuff. And they want to do that in a way that doesn't put their address in the weblogs again. Because when the NSA people look at a website, that means something to the website, especially if they want to be able to look at sensitive, criminal, other groups. So they also want defense in depth on open and classified networks. There are a number of classified networks in the US that have a million users, and all of them have to have secret clearance or better. And so the goal is you keep all the bad people away from the network, and then your network is perfectly safe. And in fact, maybe there are a few bad people out of those millions. So you might want something running on the network to protect the traffic, as well as keeping the bad people out. Okay, how's all this stuff work? You can't be anonymous by yourself. You guys are familiar with PGP, right? Okay, if Alice and Bob get together and they manage to use PGP correctly, they get their encryption. Alice sends a message to Bob, and it's encrypted. Nobody can read it on the web. If Alice and Bob get together and they say, we're going to communicate anonymously, and they're the only people doing it, they're probably not going to get the security they're looking for, because they need other people to blend with. So anonymity is trickier than encryption. You actually need some other pieces of infrastructure, you need other users in order to be able to blend together so you get your security. So when the Navy first started working on this, they said, we need the Tor network run by the Navy and obviously used only by Navy people. But if they did that, then all the connections coming out of the Navy Tor network would be Navy people, and who cares which agent they are, they're still revealing their information. So that means they have to carry traffic for other people. They need to have people in Norway, people in Iran, all over using the same network so that they can have people to blend with. But you guys aren't going to trust the Navy Tor network. So the way it has to work is you have distributed trust. You have lots of different servers all around the world, and you try to make sure that every transaction goes over at least several of them, so no single piece of the infrastructure can figure out Alice and Bob. Make sense? Great. So the security in the case of Tor depends on the diversity of the network. How many different pieces of infrastructure can you get around the world? And then the dispersal, how wide around the world can you get? And yes, criminals need anonymity, but they already have it. If you're willing to break laws, you should steal a cell phone and use it and throw it in a ditch. You should break into computers in Korea and China and Brazil and so on and run through them. If you're willing to break laws, you can get better anonymity than Tor can provide. So we should discuss that more afterwards if you like. But that's one of the first myths that people say, aren't you enabling criminals? And I say, no, I'm not enabling criminals. Criminals are going to commit crimes, and they're going to do it with Tor or without Tor. And there are many fine ways for them to commit crimes without Tor. They don't need Tor. Okay, so what security properties are we talking about here? There are different things you might try to get from an anonymity system. You might try to get communication anonymity and data anonymity. So Bob doesn't know where Alice is or who Alice is. Or we might just want communications anonymity. We might just want to hide where Alice is, but they know for sure who they are. For example, let's imagine an indie media reporter goes somewhere and he connects back to the indie media website. He wants to know for sure that it's the indie media website he's talking to, and they want to know for sure that it's him, but they don't want people monitoring either side of the transaction to be able to figure out that they're talking to each other. Another example is imagine a CIA agent goes off into the field. He wants to be able to communicate back home without having people locally say, that's an interesting person to go investigate more. So it makes perfect sense to have authenticated anonymous communication. You can SSH over Tor, and you can know for sure that you're getting the right place, and you can log in so they know you're the right one, but people watching you don't know where you're going. For example, I've used Tor on the DEF CON network so that people don't realize what server I'm going to and then attack it. Okay, so the focus of Tor is just communications anonymity. We don't care what you say over your channel. If you want to deal with data anonymity, then you have to get some other program, a web proxy or something like that, to make sure that your browser doesn't say, this is exactly what version I am, these are the languages I prefer, this is how large my window is right now, these are all the cookies you gave me last time, and so on and so forth. You need to deal with that your own way, and that's a really hard problem because of JavaScript and all sorts of other things, but one problem at a time. Okay, so a little bit of overview on how we get these sorts of anonymity. There are two basic approaches, mixes, which are high latency and quite secure, but only suitable for things that you can wait hours for. And then also proxies, which can be quite fast, but not as strong security. Anybody here read David Chom's papers or know about mixed nets or remailers or other things? Some nods of heads. Okay. So I'll give you a very brief overview of how mixes work. So the idea of a mix is we've got four people sending mail on the internet here, and we want it to be the case that somebody who can't look inside the yellow box doesn't know which message corresponds to which. So if you can't see it, then we don't know which one's which. So that's all fine and good if you trust the guy inside the yellow box. But if you don't trust that one server, then you want to use multiple servers so that you can distribute the trust. So one way this can work is, imagine we've got three servers here, and each of them has a public key. So I'm going to take my message and encrypt it with the last public key, and then encrypt that with the middle one, and then encrypt that with the first one. So the nice property here is we can send a bunch of messages. The first guy can decrypt all of them, rearrange them, send the second one, decrypt, and so on. And this means that if... This means that if that guy is honest and those two guys are bad, we still get the security that we're looking for. Because as long as any of them have not told us how they did the mixing, then we're secure. Make sense? Great. So that's all fine and good if you want to do mail. If you can wait for 4 or 5 or 10 or 100 messages to arrive and then mix them and then wait again at the next step and so on. And if you can afford to do the public key crypto, that you need to do for every message, for every step. But if you can't afford to do that, say you want to do web browsing or instant messaging or SSH, then you need something a lot faster. So the other end of the spectrum is the basic proxy. Do you guys know about anonymizer.com? Okay. It's a computer out there in San Diego, and there are a bunch of Alices on this side and a bunch of Bobs on that side, and very simple, it proxies. And this is great because it's easy to explain to people, they intuitively know what's going on, but it's bad because there's a computer there, and if you break into the computer, then it's all over. That guy can figure out all the Alices talking to all the Bobs. And you don't just have to break into the computer, you can bribe the janitor at the ISP, there are all sorts of different ways that you can break into a single computer out there. So what we'd like to do with Tor is we'd like to get the good parts from both of them. We want to take the idea of distributed trust from mixes and the idea of fast from proxies and try to combine them. So I'll tell you a little bit more in a bit about how that works. We're not the first people to have invented this stuff. There's a group in Dresden that are working on a project called YAP. There was a group in Montreal working on a project called the Freedom Network. So we didn't invent it, but we think we have the best implementation and the largest network out there. So the reason it's called Tor. Originally, it was the Onion Router project, and I was working on Onion Routing, and I told people I'm building Onion Router. And they said, oh, really? Which one? Because there's the Freedom Network and all these other ones out there. So I said, no, it's the Onion Routing network that I'm working on. So the name stuck. Or if you prefer recursive acronyms, we've got one of those as well. Okay, so we've got a network that's been running for almost 2 years now. We have 150 servers on 5 continents. We just got a server in Brazil last week, so now we're at the 5th continent. It's an anonymizing network, so I don't know how many users we have. A little while ago, we changed our web logs, so we don't keep track of anything, because Nmap and a number of other projects had visits from the FBI, and they said, if you just give us all of your logs, we'll be able to help terrorism, and that's not really something that we want to help provide. So we don't have any idea how many people download Tor, and because it's a distributed system, it's hard to tell how many users there are. In January, I looked at how many clients there were connected to the 2 servers I'm running and multiplied by the rest of the servers, and there were about 15,000 users or something, and we've gotten 50,000 or more hits a day since then. So I imagine we could be a lot higher than that. I don't know. So as servers, you can decide how much bandwidth you want to donate. Some people donate 10 kilobytes a second. Some people donate 1.5 megabytes a second. It really depends what sort of resources you have and how much you want to commit to the network. Okay, so how does Tor work? We've got Alice over here. She's running a Tor client. We've got a bunch of servers over there. So Alice does a TLS connection to the first guy, so she shares a session key with him. And as soon as either of them throw away their key material, there's nothing you can do with what you logged or breaking into either of them to reconstruct the key. So as soon as this circuit goes away, then no logs will help you. From there, she tunnels to the second guy. So the neat property here is that this guy knows about him, but doesn't know where it came from over there. And from there, she tunnels to a third one. So the property we're aiming for here is that no single server can link Alice to some website, Bob, that she connects to. Simple enough? Okay. So the way it actually works is we establish each of these session keys. So when Alice wants to make a connection to Bob, she writes down cnn.com and then wraps it in the third key, the second key, the first key, and then sends it. And each one pulls off a layer. So it looks different at each point in the network. And it's encrypted until it gets to here. This last connection is in plain text because it's going to whatever the server is, a web server. If Alice wants end-to-end encryption, then she should get that herself with SSL or whatever. And another neat property here is that we can multiplex several connections over the same circuit. So you build the circuit like that, and then you can use it for many different connections. And if we weren't concerned about security, then you should just use the same circuit forever. Because you've built it, it took a while to build, but who cares, you can use it forever. But the problem with that is that that exit node knows that the same person, an anonymous person, but who knows who it is, connected to both of these guys. And if the bottom one is Hotmail and she logged in and wrote down her real name, then the top one is associated with that user, whoever that is. So we don't want to use the same circuit forever. But we don't want to keep building a new circuit for every picture we get from CNN. So we need some sort of compromise there. Okay, where do I go to connect to the network? Alice downloads the Tor client. Now she has a piece of software in front of her. Configured in the software, hard-coded, are the addresses of 3 directory servers and the public keys for these 3 directory servers. So this means that she can go to any of those, hopefully one of them will be up, and pull down a directory, which is a big list of all the servers out there, the addresses, keys, exit policies, and so on. Now, it sort of sucks that we've got this centralization, because if you compromise one of those 3, then you can control what the client sees the network to be. But on the other hand, if we don't have these 3 directory servers, then the bad guy can sign up 50,000 servers, and we move from 150 to 50,150, and probably Alice will randomly pick bad people for her entire path. So we want to get some sort of way to protect against that attack. Right now, the simplest answer is having me make sure that the bad guy doesn't sign up a lot of nodes. But you have to trust that I know how to detect the bad guy. And bad guys are traditionally kind of tough to detect. So we're working on ways to scale the system a little bit better than that. I'd be happy to talk to you about that more afterwards and hear what you have to say. So I should point out that these directory servers are trust bottlenecks, as I just described, but they're not performance bottlenecks. You don't end up having to go to the same directory servers every single time. The reason for that is that the other servers mirror the directory, and that means that you end up being able to go to any of them once you know all the servers. But when you first start up your client at the very beginning, then yes, you have to go to the main ones. Okay, so it's written in C. It's about 30,000 lines of code. It runs in user space. You don't have to be root. You don't have to mess with your kernel. In previous designs for anonymity systems, you had to install a kernel shim, and then you had to make sure it worked with your version of the software, and so on. So you can run this as a user on somebody else's computer. You don't have to worry about trust as much as you might if you had to be root. So you can trut it and do all that stuff. We've got flexible exit policies, which means that every server can specify these are the addresses and ports that we want to let people connect to. And that means that, for example, port 25 is rejected by default, because a lot of people say, aren't you trying to destroy the world? You're going to allow spammers to spam. Actually, we're not going to allow spammers to spam. Spammers are doing fine spamming. We're not introducing any new way for them to do it. They write viruses and Trojans, and they compromise 10 million Windows machines, and you can spam very well from 10 million Windows machines. You don't need 150 Tor servers to do it. But that's a long answer, and the short answer is port 25 is rejected, so we can't spam through Tor. So it's important to keep both of those in mind, but the shorter answer is the one that convinces people better. So we just anonymize the pipe, as I mentioned before. So you need to use Provoxy or some other scrubbing web proxy if you want to not write cookies everywhere you go. So the Tor client, from Alice's perspective, looks like a SOX proxy. So anything that can go into a SOX proxy can go into Tor. So you can just configure your Mozilla or Firefox or your IRC client or whatever you want to do. In the beginning, the previous Onion Routing project was aiming to build a new proxy, an SSH proxy, an IRC proxy, an R-login proxy, and that was just a really bad idea. Okay, so it runs on Linux, BSD, OS X, Solaris, Windows. We just got a port to IRIX last week from some guy who works for SGI. I'm pretty sure people who work for SGI are the only ones who use IRIX now, but maybe there are people in the audience who disagree with that.
We got 30.
What?
We got 30 IRIX boxes.
Ah. Well, you should let me know if it actually works, because he's our only user.
No, we are getting rid of them. We have 1,500 computers and only 30 IRIX boxes.
Okay. You're in the same boat everybody else is there. So, yes, it runs on pretty much everything. We've got packages for Debian and Red Hat and Windows and OS X and so on. So it should be pretty easy to install, but there's a lot of usability stuff we need to keep dealing with. Deployment paradigm. So the Freedom Network from Zero Knowledge was an actual pay service. They tried to get users, they tried to get $50 from every user, they tried to pay their servers for the bandwidth. That really didn't work. They didn't end up with enough money to pay the servers. So what we're aiming for is a totally volunteer-based model. The servers provide servers because, hey, they're nice people and they want the internet to be more safe, and the clients use it for free because they need privacy too. So no payments and non-proprietary. Everything is open, it's free software, we tell you exactly how it works. There's a second implementation of Tor actually in Java because we provide a specification so people can do that. We're moving to a peer-to-peer incentives model because 150 servers and 15,000 users doesn't really add up very well. So maybe we can provide some sort of incentives for the users to relay traffic if they want better service from the system. Okay, so here's a graph from yesterday, I think, of the number of running Tor servers we've got. This is when we got slashdotted around Christmas, and it went up. And then this is where we had a bug in the server where if one of the servers claimed to be able to relay 1 gigabyte a second, all the other servers freaked out and crashed. Unfortunately, the clients didn't freak out and crash, just the servers. So we started with, you know, 100 servers, and then we had 50 servers, and then 30 servers, and then we still had 15,000 clients the whole time saying, I need to build a circuit, my circuit's dead, I need to build another circuit. So the remaining servers got hammered pretty hard there. But we fixed that bug, and as you see, it is climbing back up again.
What happened on the next dump?
Here?
Yeah?
I'm not sure. There were a couple of... that might have been another crash bug, but I don't think it was. Right about there was when some guy went to Google Groups from as many Tor servers as he could and published an email on some Usenet group with a whole bunch of email addresses. Then he sent mail to the ISPs from the Tor servers and said, look, it's a spammer. You should turn him off. And then a lot of the Tor servers running on cable modem machines and so on got turned off or decided that this wasn't what they signed up for. So there's an example of an attack on the system that we need to be robust against. So we're pushing 5 to 10 megabytes a second on average, which is a pretty substantial amount. It's more than the Freedom Network did. I haven't compared it to Jap recently, but it's quite a bit of traffic. This is the point where the crash bug happened, and it's also right about there, the point where we decided that BitTorrent was just hammering the network too hard, and we'd like to move to a more decentralized model where we can have 1 million clients sign up and they can all relay traffic for each other, but not yet, because there are a lot of other security problems and scalability and engineering problems we need to deal with. So what we did there is we asked people to change their exit policies to refuse the default file sharing ports. And that means that we drop from 10 or so to 4 or 5 or so. And that's promising because that means we've got 4 or 5 megabytes a second on average of web browsing and instant messaging and stuff like that, which is quite a bit. Okay, so I told you about forward anonymity. I told you about Alice wants to go to a website without the website knowing where she's coming from. So that's nice, but let's use that as a building block to build something better. Let's build location hidden services. Bob wants to run an Apache server without letting anybody know what continent it's running on. And this should be a server that Bob doesn't have to change at all. Apache should just run like it normally does. Except we should let people access it only via Tor, so nobody knows where the computer is. In particular, we want it to be accessible from anywhere. Anybody who can use Tor can get to the service. We want it to resist censorship. If you don't know where it is, you can't go ask somebody to turn it off. We don't want Bob to have to run 45 Apache servers all around the world in order to get his censorship resistance. We want it maybe to be able to provide selective service, even when it's getting DOS'd.
Thank you.
Imagine that you have, if Bob runs one Apache server and you know the IP address, then you should just DOS it and it'll go away. And if he runs four, then it's not that much harder to DOS four machines than one. But if you have to hit the whole Tor network to take the service out, then maybe it's a little bit more robust. And while you're hitting the whole Tor network and you're hitting Bob, we want it to be the case that Bob can refuse to answer some people and choose for himself which ones he wants to answer. Maybe Alice will show up with special tokens and say, I'm the special Alice, can you please let me through the website even though you're getting attacked? And also resistant to physical attack. The same sort of situation as above, but let's imagine now we're talking about the US military setting up a website. And their adversary doesn't come in the form of network attacks. It comes in the form of a very large fighter plane dropping a bomb on the city. But if they don't know which city to drop a bomb on, then I guess we're secure even against that. So that's a pretty tough set of requirements. Let me pull the top off of this. Well, I'll not pull the top off of this. Okay, so how do we do this? In the first case, let's imagine Bob is over there. He picks some introduction points. he picks some servers out on the network, some Tor servers, and he onion routes out to them using the circuit thing I described before, and he holds those connections open. In the simple scenario, this is the one we don't use, but I'll explain to you why, and then I'll explain the other one. In the simple scenario, Alice somehow learns about the introduction points, and then she connects to one and says, "Hi, I'm Alice. I'd love to talk to you. If you want to talk, answer me." So that's great. Alice gets her anonymity because she onion routes out. Bob gets his anonymity because he onion routes out. But the problem is, nobody wants to run those introduction points. I talked to a bunch of cypherpunks out there, and they're happy to run remailers, but they really don't want to run that because they're producing the bytes from Bob's service, whatever it is, and they don't really have control over what Bob's service is. So the way we do it instead, like true computer scientists, we add another layer of indirection. So the way this works is Bob publishes his service descriptor, which is the public key, the introduction points he's picked, and so on, to some directory service. Right now, the directory servers play this role, but it could be any sort of key value lookup system on the net. So Alice gets it somehow, and when I do my demo, I'll show you what somehow means. And she picks a rendezvous point. She picks some other Tor server out there. She onion routes out to him and then holds open the connection. And then she goes to one of the introduction points and says, "Hi, I'm Alice. This is the rendezvous point I picked. This is the rendezvous cookie that you're going to need to talk to me over there. These are whatever authentication tokens you want to hear from me. By default, nothing. Here is the first half of my session key that we're going to exchange." And then if Bob wants to, he connects to the rendezvous point, which hooks them all up. So the neat property here is that the rendezvous point doesn't know Alice, doesn't know Bob, and can't read any of the traffic that is being sent across it. So we could, for example, put the rendezvous point in New York City, which has lots of bandwidth, and we could put the introduction points on a small island in the Caribbean, which have pleasant jurisdictions, and everything should work out. So far, so good. Okay. So a little bit on how to analyze security. There's a lot more to it than this, but one slide should get you thinking. There are lots of different ways of doing this. Here's one. Assume the adversary owns C of the N nodes in the system. Assume there are 100 Tor servers and he owns 10 of them. So, what's the chance for a random Alice talking to a random Bob that the adversary wins? That is, he links Alice to Bob. In the case of Tor, because it's a low latency system, because we want to be fast, if you're able to get the first node and the last node, then there are great statistical attacks you can use to match, to be able to know that this is the right one. And that means that we basically give up at that point. If you can see the beginning and the end, you win. If you can't see both the beginning and the end, then you don't win. So in the Tor case, Alice loses if she has a bad choice at the beginning. There's a C over N chance of that. And a bad choice at the end, C over N chance of that. So we can think of it as 1% or something like that. Do you guys know about FreeNet and systems like that? Kind of, sort of. Okay. There are other systems, like FreeNet and Peekabooty and 6.4 and so on. They have a different algorithm for making a circuit. In the case of Tor, Alice picks her whole path. It's called a free graph network. In the case of FreeNet, Alice goes to the first guy and says, "Hey, can you build me a circuit?" And then the next guy says, "Sure," and goes to some other guy and says, "Hey, can you build me a circuit?" And eventually one of them says, "No, I don't want to. I think your circuit's probably done by now." Which is great because you don't have to know all the nodes in the network in order to end up with a circuit. But it's really bad because if the first guy you pick is evil, then he smiles at you and says, "I'd be happy to build you a very safe circuit." And then he picks his friends for all the rest of it. And that means that if you pick the wrong guy first, then you lose. So 10%. And then JAP is a little bit harder to analyze. Tor uses a free route network, which is Alice gets to pick everybody and everybody can connect to everybody. JAP uses what's called a cascade network, where there's a first node that everybody goes into, and then everybody goes to the second, and the third, and out. And if you're talking about mixing, this is a pretty good idea, because all the messages come into one place, and then you can mix them and go to the next. But if you're talking about browsing the web or something that needs speed, then you just look at the endpoints, and you see 49,000 bytes come in and 49,000 bytes come out. So you're able to correlate pretty well which person's which. And you need a lot of padding in order to protect against that attack. And you need to slow things down enough that all of your users will get upset and leave. So JAP doesn't do padding, which means that all you really need to do is look at the endpoints of each cascade. And I've also got anonymizer up there for comparison, a one-hop proxy. So if C is zero, then you're all set, you're safe. If C is not zero, then you're totally screwed. So it's a much simpler analysis, but worth comparing. Okay, so the current code is freely available. Three clause BSD license, freer than free, if you're a GPL fan. We can discuss that later as well. It comes with a specification. Somebody else has built another one. We've got a design paper. We've got all sorts of stuff, tor.eff.org. Or you can Google for Tor and ignore the publisher. We're hit number three. Eventually, we'll be hit number one. Okay. Yes, question?
Is it included in any of the Linux distributions?
It's in Debian. I have to get installed Tor. I don't think it's in stable, but it's in whatever that intermediary one.
Unstable, Sarch,
yeah.
Testing.
It's not in Sarch. It's only in unstable.
It's not in testing because I keep putting out new versions of Tor which are incompatible with ones from a while ago. So if anybody ever put a version of Tor in something which is supposed to work for the next 6 years, 8 years, how long do they wait in between Debian? So you better not actually burn any specific version of Tor onto a CD at this point. But that's the only major bug that's been filed against it. The upstream doesn't want it to be turned into stable. So yes, it's in that one. We haven't really worked much with the RPM folks to get it into any of the Fedora directories, but if you know them, we'd be happy to chat about that. Did that answer the question? Great. Okay, so policy and abuse issues. Here are a couple examples of what we've seen and how we've dealt with them. One of the first ones is spam. Everybody says, aren't you destroying the world with spam? I answered that earlier, but that doesn't seem to convince most people. They still think anonymity equals spam, even though in this case it doesn't. In particular, there are all sorts of exciting spam blacklists that go around looking for open proxies, and because you seem sort of like an open proxy, therefore you will spam, therefore you're bad. So we're trying to educate all the blacklist groups on the internet about how the internet really works, and that's a hard task, but somebody's got to do it. And until then, I recommend you avoid blacklists that are stupid. So the other issue, Google Groups, I described earlier. I'm told by a friend of mine who runs a lot of remailers that in the remailer community, as soon as a new remailer shows up, he gets a lot of abuse right off by people who want to try to make sure he's never a remailer. And once he survives that for a week or so, then there's almost no abuse after that. So there are people out there who hate anonymity networks and they try to make them go away. But if you can survive a little bit of complaints, then they leave you alone. That seems to be the pattern, which is sort of an odd pattern, but we didn't know these things before we started deploying it to our network, and now we do. Wikipedia bans most of the Tor servers from writing to Wikipedia. And the reason for that is Wikipedia is a whole bunch of people, and some of them claim to be in charge every once in a while, and nobody really knows who's in charge. And some guy said, anonymity is scary, so let's ban all of these things. He has taken it upon himself to identify every possible open relay on the internet and ban them all from Wikipedia. And of course, since Tor has a directory and enumerates all the Tor servers, we were the easy one to start with. And he's going to get to the other 1.5 million open relays on the internet real soon now. But for now, he started with us. We've been talking to the people who actually run Wikipedia, who are not this guy, and we're going to add a patch to the Wikipedia code that will allow them to deal better with this. They already have to deal with exactly this problem, because AOL has only about 20 IP addresses, and so they periodically ban all of AOL, and then they hear a bunch of complaints on IRC, so they have to unban them. So they're already dealing with the concept of, this is an IP address which produces both good people and bad people. So the patch which we're considering is a big red button, and you press the button, and all of Tor is banned for 15 minutes, and then 15 minutes later, all of Tor becomes unbanned. So that seems like an okay compromise at first. I'd rather have a better answer for them, like make them have better user authentication or something like that, but they're big fans of openness, as long as you don't want privacy also. But I think that's going to work out. So another fun issue is IRC. FNET bans Tor. I'm okay with that. I don't see any useful reason for getting to FNET anyway, so that's probably fine by me. Freenode, on the other hand, thought about banning Tor for a little while, and then they decided that they wanted to enable people to get to Freenode privately. So they have problems with trolls showing up, and there are entire groups of 50 trolls, and they show up on a channel, and they start talking to each other very subtly. And after a while, the whole conversation has moved over to yelling at each other about something totally different. But the way there, nobody really notices it's happening until it's too late. So people were showing up over Tor, all 50 of them, slowly, and then they would derail the conversation. So what Freenode has done is they've started labeling people as Tor users. So now in your channel, if 50 Tor users start showing up subtly, and then they start saying stuff to each other that seems a little bit weird, it's a lot easier for you to say, hey, wait a minute, all these guys are Tor users, what's going on here? And this means that those attacks have stopped because they don't work anymore. So that's a success story where you can figure out how to do authentication without having to identify exactly who the person is on the other end and play well with privacy systems. DMCA. Periodically, people on the internet get cease and desist orders or lawsuits or other things like that. And I'm not going to comment here on whether it's legal to send all of those the way they're doing it or not. But one thing we've noticed is there's a special explicit exemption, safe harbor, in the DMCA for pretty much exactly what Tor servers do. If people running Tor servers were liable for the stuff that their Tor servers do, the bytes that come out, similarly, Cisco routers would be liable for the bytes that come out of them. There's an explicit safe harbor for people carrying bytes in a content-neutral way and not storing any of them on their server. So we've got a document where if you get a cease and desist order to your university or your company or whatever, and then they send it to you, you can send back a document saying, the EFF lawyers say that we are covered under this. Here's the case law that describes exactly why. Let me tell you a little bit about this Tor thing that I'm running, and thank you, have a nice day. This convinced Harvard General Counsel, and it's convinced a number of other universities as well, but there's still plenty more we need to do on that count, because there are many universities where the lawyers are paid to say no, and you need to give them some reason to say yes, like research or something like that. And then another abuse example, this hasn't happened lately. I think it only happened a couple of times when we were first starting up. Somebody goes to Hotmail and sends a death threat or hate mail or some sort of something or other to somebody. And then the FBI shows up and says, hey, who sent that mail? And then the Tor server operator explains Tor to the FBI agent, and he says, oh well, thanks. And that's the end of that. Interestingly, it's always an FBI agent. Even in Germany and the UK and Australia and so on, it's always an FBI agent saying, hey, who sent that mail? So I maybe US companies are the target of all the abuse so far. I don't know. So maybe this is a good time for people studying anonymous credentials to work on other approaches for people being able to authenticate without having to reveal their exact identity to systems like Wikipedia or stuff like that.
Wouldn't the same thing that you talked about on IRC work on Wikipedia as well? If you just tag the diffs with that they are from Tor nodes, so that somebody that was afraid of people from Tor putting in wrong information, you could just check the diffs that were tagged with Tor?
You'd think so, but they don't like doing that. In particular, if good people do stuff with Tor and bad people do stuff with Tor, they want to be able to say, that IP address is a bad IP address, so remove everything that's ever done and don't let it come back. They don't want to pump through manually all of the things that an IP address does. Now, I just told you that, and say that Wikipedia manually looks at all of their web pages because people periodically write Wikipedia sucks on the web pages, and they have to notice that and revert it. So they want to only have to do that sometimes, but they're willing to do that most of the time. So that answer doesn't make much sense, which I am sorry, I can't help you. Go talk to the Wikipedia people about their policies. But I agree, it's sort of an odd set of policies they come up with. And that's because they are 50 different people, and each of them wants something totally different. Plenty of them are very happy to have anonymous communications. Plenty of them think that anonymity is a shameful thing, and what do you have to hide? Please go away. And plenty of them are in between. Make sense? Sort of, yes. Okay, so there are a bunch of other technical things we need to think about as well. One of the first ones is, do we want to be low latency or high latency? We've got two projects we're working on. One of them is called MixMinion, which is the successor to MixMaster. It's for email anonymity, where you actually want to wait 3 or 4 hours or more before your message goes through. And then the other one is Tor, which I've been telling you about. Another question we have to ask is packet level versus stream level capture. The Freedom Network had a kernel shim to grab all the IP packets and normalize them a little bit and then send them to the other end of the network and put them on back on the network. This is great because all you have to do is put something into the socket layer to grab all the packets. But it's not so good because you have to mess with the kernel and be root. You have to, you're still going to have to normalize the application level stuff. If you grab all the web requests that have cookies in them and you send them to the other end and you send the cookies on their way, then you're not getting the privacy that you might want to get. And there are a bunch of other issues that go in there as well. Another question, padding versus no padding. Periodically I hear from technical people who say, well, this is great, but why don't you just send all the time and then all of those attacks you talked about would go away? There are two problems with that. One of them is, if everybody sends all the time, then we're talking about a whole lot more bandwidth than I've been talking about so far. In particular, the servers are going to end up getting sent at all the time, and there's going to be a lot more bandwidth they have to carry. Since it's a volunteer-based server network, then we really don't want to have to afford that. So the other reason why sending all the time doesn't solve things is the network is not perfect. Alice sends all the time, except her network doesn't work for a half second. So now there's a blip going through the padding she sends, and that blip can be seen on the other side as well. In fact, the adversary can induce the blip by DOSing her with specific patterns, and then there are three little blips, and then three little blips. So given that the basically the statistical attack moves from look at patterns in where there is traffic to look at patterns where there is no traffic, and it's about the same attack. So given those two issues, we're not convinced that we should do padding yet, and maybe if somebody tells us a perfect padding scheme, we'll move to it. But until then, I'm not going to deal with it. Another question, user interfaces. Right now, Tor works just like a normal server, like Apache or whatever. So if it works, it's working great. And if it doesn't work, you have to go find some log file where it spit out the reason why it didn't start. which is great if you know what you're doing, but if you don't know where the log file is, then you'll never know why your Tor isn't working. And it's worse than that because, I'll give you an example. When we first started doing this and I didn't have much documentation, I would periodically hear from people who had just installed Tor, and they would say, Tor is great, it's wonderful, it's just as fast as my normal net connection. And I would say, well, wait a minute, you're not using Tor, you just think you are. And so we need some way to provide user feedback so that they know when their traffic is going through Tor and they know when their traffic is going out directly. Another fun question, AS level paths. Are some of you ISP guys? So there's this thing called an AS, an autonomous system. It's a unit on the internet, an ISP or something like that. So one of the questions we asked was, so far every time I've given you a graph, I think of Alice and then a line and then the first server. So we think to ourselves, can we see that cable between Alice and the first server? But that line is not just a physical cable somewhere in Norway or Kansas or something. That line is a connection through many different ISPs, going up to the backbones like AT&T and then going back down again to whatever the local ISP for that Tor server is. And so we need to start thinking, do you want to switch film?
In 4 minutes,
okay. So we need...
Let's say three,
okay. So we need to start thinking about what are the chances that the path from Alice to the first node overlaps in some way with some ISP with the path from the last node to Bob. Because it's not just a matter of can you see the first node and the last node. Now it's a matter of are you on any piece of the path on the first link or any piece of the path on the last link. And we actually looked at the Tor network as it was deployed 6 months ago. And there were quite a few cases, about a quarter of the time, in fact, there was some ISP, usually a top-level ISP like Sprint or AT&T and so on, that were able to observe random Alices and random Bobs. So that's pretty scary. If you're talking about a telephone company class adversary, they're pretty good at monitoring the internet, especially with the sorts of Tor volunteer servers we've been getting. And that attack is not as good against the Mixmaster network. I've been trying to figure out why that is. I've got some theories so far. One of the biggest ones is that the Mixmaster network doesn't need to be fast. So they have servers and islands in Greece and so on that mail gets to once a day and mail leaves once a day, and that's good enough. But since the Tor servers have to have quite a bit of bandwidth, then they're more likely to be close to one of the top tier ISPs. And that means that they're more likely to be observable by that ISP or something like that. Another interesting result there is that people always say, well, we should get another Tor server in India or Pakistan or South Africa or somewhere weird so that you make sure to go from the US to somewhere weird and then back. So if your adversary is somebody in the US watching you, then they see your request, leave, come back, and go somewhere. And almost certainly, the leaving and come back goes over the same path, goes over the same ISP. So you're not actually confusing anybody if your adversary is that big by getting a server out in the middle of nowhere. And in fact, if you only pick like three hops for your path, and you spend one of them going out and another one going back, then you're getting a lot less security than you're thinking you're getting, because you're wasting most of your three hops in a way that the adversary can watch. Okay, incentives to run servers. Cut. Okay, so it's okay. If my laptop turns off, then we know why. Okay, so another question. I talked a little bit about incentives to run servers. We need to maybe provide some way for you to want to relay traffic. For example, let's say we keep track of who has what exit policy and we try them periodically. And if you ask us to relay traffic for you and you worked for us in the past, and then we are more willing to give you a service. And that means that if there's plenty of service out there, then everybody gets good service. But if most of the network is full, then only the other servers get good service. Maybe this will work, maybe it won't. We're going to give it a try in a little bit and see. But even past that, we want to not just look at whether you relay traffic, we want to look at whether you allow exiting, because that's the real limiting factor. Okay, enclave level onion routers. When I talk to corporations and governments and say, yes, every employee should run a Tor client on their laptop, on their desktop, and that way nobody, not even you, will be able to tell where they're going, they get pretty upset. So there are other approaches you can take to deploying Tor. In particular, you should run the Tor client on the firewall, and that means all the connections inside the network are go in plain text to the firewall, and then are secure out of the firewall. So this means that the systems administrators can look at all the stuff and say, well, you're not allowed to go there, you can't do that, or you're not allowed to go there, I'm going to fire you, or whatever their policy specifies they should do. But the company itself is securing its transactions outside of the company. An example that makes sense when I talk to corporations is Monster.com. Monster.com collects a lot of information about who wants to get a new job where. And it's not just who actually writes down, I am looking for a new job. But if a whole lot of engineers from Cisco suddenly start looking at Monster.com, this is interesting business intelligence information that maybe Monster should consider selling to somebody who wants to pay a lot for it. I don't know. I don't know if they're doing this yet. I don't know if you should break into the Monster database and learn it for yourself and sell it to somebody. But companies might have a responsibility to make sure that this information is not revealed to the outside world, because once it's out, then you can't really put it back in. Path length. Obviously, one hop is not enough. So two is better than one. I don't think 10 hops is any better than 9 hops, because the attacks happen at the endpoints. If you can see the beginning and the end, then you win, and if you can't, then we win. So it doesn't matter to have that many hops in the middle, but we figure maybe one hop in the middle is better than 0 hops in the middle. I'd love to have a more formal security argument than that, but that's pretty much our security argument at this point. So we've got 3 hops right now, which we figure is pretty good, and maybe we'll have something better later on. China. So a lot of people always say, why do you have the directory public so everybody can download it and enumerate all the China Tor server, all the non-China Tor servers, and then block them all? Maybe we should fix that at some point, but clients need to be able to get the directory to know where the servers are. So it's not clear to us how to get the directory to the good guys without letting the bad guys get it. So there are 4 big issues that we need to solve. There are people in China using Tor right now. There are people in Iran who used to be blogging 2 months ago, and then their country decided that they shouldn't blog anymore. I believe some of them are using Tor as well. But it's not really as suited for situations like this as we'd like it to be. There are 4 things we need to do in order to make that happen. One of them is we need a set of exit nodes on the free side that are willing to connect to arbitrary IP addresses. We're coming up with those right now. Those are the Tor exit nodes. The other one is we need a set of entry nodes on the free side. We don't just want 150 entry nodes. We want, say, 15,000 or 20,000 entry nodes. And we're coming up with those. Those are the Tor clients. I imagine in another version or two, we have a little button at the top of the GUI that says Help China. And if you click it, then you relay maybe 2 kilobytes a second. And that doesn't seem much to you, but it seems a whole lot to a guy in China who has 0 kilobytes a second currently. So maybe that means that we'll end up with a lot of different IP addresses, and it will be hard to enumerate and block all of them. I heard a fun story from a guy who worked at Cisco. He was the number 8 employee at Cisco. So back then, everybody was doing all the different jobs they had to do. And they got a tech support call from somebody, and they said, our gateway firewall keeps crashing. We've got a big block list, and it keeps crashing. So they started asking various questions, and it turned out that they had 1.5 million IP addresses in the block list on the firewall, And in fact, the way the Cisco router worked was it did a linear search over all of them. So of course it kept crashing. And then it turns out that it was China calling them for tech support because they had a linear search over them. So it turns out that China doesn't use Cisco anymore for their firewall, for their great firewall of China, because some other company provided something that didn't do a linear search. And so they're happier using them. So there's the side story there. Okay, so those are the first two things. We need exit nodes and we need entry nodes. On top of that, we need some way to provide all of the IP addresses for the entry nodes to the Chinese dissident without also giving them to the Chinese government. That's a really hard problem because the Chinese government can look like a bunch of dissidents. So how can we tell the difference? We've got a couple of ideas on how we might go about solving that. One of the first steps you have to do is you have to identify some trust seeds. You have to say, these guys we're pretty sure are okay. They're actual people who want to make use of this anonymity software, not just enumerate the entry nodes. From there, you need some sort of way of delegating the trust in some sort of way. There's a website called Advogado. Are you guys familiar with it? No. So there's a website called Advogado, and they have a trust scheme, and the idea is the adversary can't sign up more than a certain number of new people and get them trusted, and that number is not proportional to the number of new accounts they make. It's proportional to the number of people they convince to trust them. So we need to get some sort of trust scheme like that, so the number of IP addresses that end up in the hands of the adversary is proportional to the number of actual humans that he suckers into believing him. And that certainly requires some more work. So that's the third one. Yes, question?
Well, if you have continue on that thread, just do that. I have a question to the previous points.
Go for it.
Okay, you mentioned the padding versus no padding, and I didn't really get the argument because you don't have to do continuous padding. You can do random padding. And then you can't really see the holes in the communications anymore.
So what you're suggesting is Alice should start out on the Alice side, and she will use some pattern known only to her, and she will pad with that pattern.
Or each and every server will do some padding as well.
Each and every server will do that as well. So what you've just brought that from is an obviously workable statistical attack to a just as workable but not as obviously workable statistical attack. Mm-hmm. Because in fact, if you randomly choose when you're going to send stuff, obviously when you're sending nothing, you're sending nothing. And if you randomly go like this, then sometimes you'll be sending less. And when you're sending less padding or total traffic, then you're obviously not sending more real traffic than you're sending padded traffic. Makes sense so far?
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of information given to the adversary over time allows him to figure out when you are sending and when you're not sending. Not in specific cases, but over time, given a set of Alice's he looks at and a set of Bob's he looks at, he can say with increasing confidence, I'm pretty sure it's this Alice and that Bob. There's a lot of math behind it. Those sorts of end-to-end statistical attacks are still an open research question. I haven't seen any design which I believe would not fall to these statistical attacks. Mm-hmm. But there's still a chance for you to write one down and convince us all of it. If you want to do some research on that, I'd be happy to work with you. But as far as I can tell, most people who come up with variants of padding designs like that, typically the approach they make is, well, obviously the attacker can beat this, so let's make this thing more complicated. And soon it will be so complicated that I don't understand it, I don't see how to break it. And then they make the leap, which is, and therefore the adversary doesn't know how to break it. And that last leap is the one where a lot of people make it. So, yeah, I'd be happy to talk to you about that more afterwards. But I don't think so, but I'm not sure is the answer. Okay, so China, exit nodes? Entry nodes. Yes, question.
Yeah, except for the obvious bandwidth problem. If you pad it to be a continuous stream of data, as you said, then if you stop the sender, the client, from sending, you should see the holes at the end as well. But what if the server, one of the server that receives this data sees that hole and fills it? Then you have a continuous stream of data coming out.
Except for the fact that the nodes in the middle of the network are going to see the holes and know about them. So it's only going to be somebody watching the network, or after that, on a server that fixes it. So yes, that's a better answer. And I don't know if statistical attacks would work against that sort of defense. I'd love to know the answer either way. It needs more research. But even if that is bulletproof, including against an active attacker that attacks in the middle and forces not much to happen there, and then detects whether there's a hole coming out or not, you've got an answer. Then even against that sort of thing, you're still going to be very expensive. So that's an argument in itself. Yes?
Well, the server in between cannot fill gaps other than between the servers, because it can't add anything to the protocol. So the pattern on the outside will be actually exactly the same as it was before the server filled in the stream, because the server can only fill in the stream between the servers. The server cannot.
The server cannot
participate. Cannot participate in the communication.
But there is a layer of encryption on each of through each of the server, isn't there?
So but the last connection to Bob is in plain text.
Yeah.
And it makes no sense to pad to a website.
No.
The HTTP protocol doesn't have that. So it certainly makes no sense for the server in the middle to somehow generate stuff which will decrypt correctly and keep all the stream ciphers in sync and so on. So yes, that's another good answer. Yeah. Yes?
The point of padding with some kind of statistical algorithm, to get mentioned, wouldn't it be to keep the convergence rate of this algorithm so slow that it couldn't really be used in practice? Like when you try to break some kind of encryption, it's not theoretically invisible, but it's practically invisible to break them.
Yes, that would be the goal. And nobody has shown me one, and shown me also that the statistical attacks on it are all slow. I would love to see that as a result. And somewhere in the back of my mind, I believe that such a thing could be found. But I worry that the one that people would find is still very expensive in terms of bandwidth overhead. So the holy grail of padding would be a cheap padding scheme that you can't learn much from by watching it for a little while. And maybe we'll have one of those one day. I don't know. Okay, China. Exit nodes, entry nodes, a way of getting IP addresses from me on the free side to the dissidents without giving them to the bad guys as well. And then the fourth thing is, once the dissidents in China have the IP address for the Tor entry node, how do they get there without advertising that they're Tor users? We've got a little bit of an answer to that right now, because Tor only does two protocols. It does HTTP when you're pulling down a directory, and it does HTTPS, TLS, when you're talking between the two servers. So if you look at a guy very briefly, you will say, oh, he's just browsing the web. But if you look at him for quite a while, you will see he seems to be making persistent encrypted connections to these groups of servers out there. So he's not going to have the statistical behavior patterns that normal web browsing people do. And that's really bad, because then they'll decide he's probably a Tor user, and they'll go knock on his door or whatever it is they do to dissidents that they don't like. So we need some sort of magic steganography that actually works and is feasible and is practical. I say magic because I'm not convinced we will ever have one. So we need to somehow change our assumptions so that we can have him able to use the Tor network without having people mind? That's an open question. We're not working on that one either yet because we've got our hands full with just building the Tor network itself. So far, so good. Okay, and then the last one I sort of talked about already. Right now we have a static network, 150 servers or so, and we really need to bring that to 20,000 servers, not just 250 servers. So we need to do some sort of incentive scheme so that people are willing to actually run servers. Okay, so let me... I just booted this thing, so we'll start up the screen and start up a Tor. Oh, I should get myself a network first. And I should get myself a... let's see. Where do these things live on Red Hat?
What's your battery status?
Oh, I probably have plenty of battery. There you go. You guys can watch my battery status. Come on, little Ethernet. You can do it. So I'm going to... Yeah, I've got packets coming. It'll be there soon enough. Unless I don't. Yep, well, you're all set there. Oop, I'm seeing my DHCP requests and I'm getting a knack. Why would they be knacking me? This is the reason why we should get a network before the talk starts.
Maybe they changed the network configuration and didn't tell us because we have never asked for a network to be working.
It's a possibility. Well, I'm seeing packets, but that doesn't mean it's going to give me a network. So, while I'm playing with this, you guys should ask questions, and I'll see if I can end up with a network at the end. Or if we have a Red Hat sysadmin here who wants to come play with my laptop at the root prompt, I trust you.
when you were talking about the problems in China, wouldn't it be a scheme to just reroute through clients on the inside sometimes and try to create those kind of burst loads you would get from internet connections so that at least the connections would be on a low level on the inside of the Great Firewall and then they come as burst loads to the outside?
Yes, maybe. All of my answers about China will be yes, maybe, I'm afraid. So they are running a freenet network inside China because most of the Great Firewall stuff is just about the borders. So anybody inside China tries to get a web page, and if they can get it, they put it into the internal network, the cache thing, and now everybody inside can go there and see if they've got a copy inside. Similarly, we could have a Tor network running inside China, and some of the nodes in the Tor network would be able to gateway to the real Tor network in maybe a connection that the Chinese people don't look at very much, or whatever. Ooh. Well, it ran, but it didn't answer. So that would be one great answer. If there are some ways of getting from inside China to outside of China, then we can allow everybody else to automatically piggyback off of those. And using the hidden service feature, you didn't see it, but the rest of these guys did. So the feature there is Bob can run an Apache server without anybody knowing where it is. Similarly, Bob could run a gateway proxy without anybody in the China Tor network knowing the IP address of this proxy, yet they could get to it via the Tor network. So now the Chinese bad people can't just sign up on the Tor network and know where the proxy is. Nobody knows where the proxy is except the guy offering it. And it could move around or who knows. So that would be pretty spiffy if we could get that working. First of all, we have to get a Tor network working inside China. Second, we need to get it scalable enough and usable enough and stable enough that we can just hand it to somebody on a CD when we go to China and have it all work from there. We're kind of a long way from that. But even if we did that, there are lots of other things we've got to deal with first. Yeah, I've got no network. So be it. So I'd be happy to work with you to answer those other two impossible questions if you have one of those. I also have no idea if there are any connections from inside China to outside China that aren't monitored at all. And I don't know if dissidents live on the other end of either of those connections. Other questions?
A few years ago, I heard this rumor about the anonymous emailers, where most of them are being run by the government's secret agencies, keeping track of the emails going through them. Because if you want to know what secret messages are going on, why should you leave it to the good guys to run the anonymous emailers? Why don't you put up your own and anonymize it? How can we tell that the 150 Tor servers aren't run by the different agencies sharing information, or who are you? Maybe you are one of their secret agents.
Yep. Speaking of which, let me back up a second. The Tor project started at the US Navy with DARPA funding and other Navy funding. And now we are funded by the Electronic Frontier Foundation for exactly the same thing. We're the first technology project to be able to say that. And the reason for that is that both sides want anonymity, as I described earlier in the talk. I'm trying to get both sides to realize that they both want anonymity, and it's okay that they both want anonymity and that they need the same network to be able to get that security properties. So you're right, here I am from the DoD and here I am from the EFF. And how should you trust me? Why should you trust me? One answer is that you've heard me give the talk and I seem like a nice guy and I'm going to go drink a beer with you later. Maybe. That's an answer. It's a hard question. So the better answer would be I'm going to decentralize the directory servers so you don't have to trust the people running the network to keep the good guys in and the bad guys out. For example, anybody might run a directory server, and the goal of the directory server is just to keep track of what Tor servers are out there, and each person can decide for himself which Tor servers he wants to allow onto the network. So that's a fine answer, but it's not the right one, because I'm writing the code. And it's free software and open source, but there are 30,000 lines of it, so I might slip something in somewhere. So really, you've got to trust me. I mean, I'd like a better answer than that, but I'm writing the code. Feel free to look at it. Have your friends look at it. That would be actually really good, because the more people who look at it, the more likely it is that it's secure. Anybody know any better answers than how do we trust you? You can look at my PGPiKey and see that it is signed by many people that you have heard of and might trust, if that's an answer.
I trust the NSA and CIA to do a really good job at making undercover agents.
How can I attempt to? So, at the risk of making this even worse, I worked at NSA for a summer, a couple of years back. The thing that I learned was that they're really not all that competent, and they're really not all that good at doing anything. And in particular, they're scared to death of doing anything public. So I would find it really hard to believe that government organizations would try to act like us and succeed. That would be pretty tricky, running a remailer in the remailer community. Now again, the next sentence I want to say is, And I've met many of the people who run remailers, and I don't think they're in, but you don't have to. I'm not the one who should be telling you that.
No.
You should meet them yourself and decide if, in fact, the many groups out there, the many intelligence agencies out there, have actually put this much energy into undermining the whole dissident community and, in fact, creating the dissident community. That would seem pretty weird on their part. But it's an excellent question, and unfortunately, I'm just some guy you met today. And in fact, FFI brought me in here, so who knows? So I'm not the one who can make you trust all of these privacy systems, but I can explain how they work and give you all the source code for them. So don't use my network. Go run your own if you need to. But if there are a bunch of little Tor networks, then they're not as secure as a big Tor network. Is that an answer?
I think there is a good answer to that one.
Okay. Well, I'll see what I can do to come up with the right answer. Yeah, it doesn't like me. Maybe I should become some of these other Mac addresses. I don't think I should do that on tape.
We would rather come back next month, so you shouldn't.
So Tor should be pretty easy to demo. Let me tell you what you would get if you were seeing my Tor demo right now. So basically, Tor runs a SOX proxy, and I have another web proxy called Privoxy that I run, and then I have a Firefox out there that you're seeing in the background. And so when I type google.com into my Firefox, it goes to Privoxy and sends it to Tor, and Tor sends it to the other end of the Tor network, which resolves it and then connects to Google. So if the exit node that I happen to pick is in Norway, then I end up with google.no. If it's in Venezuela, I end up with google.whatever their two-letter domain is. So you can see Google in all sorts of different languages. So that's the first piece of the demo. And then there are a lot of websites out there that can show you what IP they think you're coming from. And we can go to them and see that the IP changes all the time. You guys can do this demo at home so far. And then there are also hidden services. The way that Bob actually communicates his introduction points to Alice is he writes down somewhere on a business card, on a website, something like that, a host name, which is the base32 of a public key, .onion. So it's yay long, and you can click on it. And the way the .onion address works is you type it into Firefox, or you click on it, and then it gets passed to Privoxy, which passes it to Tor, and Tor says, oh, that's a .onion address. That's a special address. I'm going to deal with it specially. And the way it works is it goes to the directory servers, says, hey, can you give me the self-signed service descriptor for this public key, gets it back. Because it's blah, 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 .onion, you can use the blah, blah, blah to make sure that it's the right public key and is signed by that key, so you know you're going to the right service. And then you can pull down the list of introduction points from the thing you just downloaded and pick one of them and so on. So in particular, we have a hidden service, which is a wiki. And so somebody somewhere out there ran a hidden service wiki, and other people anonymously go to this wiki and anonymously sign up their anonymous services. So there's a list of 15 or so other hidden services you can go to from there. And you guys are welcome to run one as well. So the best answer I can give you is we're being open and explaining it as best we can. And you have to decide for yourself if the code, design, current implementation, network, and so on are trustworthy.
Any plans for RFC specification?
The funny thing about RFCs, requests for comments, is that if you have any intent to get comments, it is far too early to write an RFC. You should only write the RFC once you don't want any comments anymore. We still want comments. So yes, one day we will specify this. We do have a byte-level specification, which is in RFC style, and you can take a look at it and see if it convinces you of how things work. But I don't want to go to the IETF anytime soon. They're not usually very friendly to people who just want to get their design out there and their specification out there. But one day. once everything's more stable? Yes.
Doesn't match my experience with ITF being part of a few of the draft writing groups, so maybe it's not always like that.
I will come to you when we want to do our RFC.
I'll put you in touch with Harald to understand instead.
Okay.
Should we hit for the bear?
Okay.
Because the time and you don't getting an IP address, so not much what to do.
Yep. I'm getting a lot of packets though.
Yeah.
Whoever those are.
Well, I'm looking at Nasty Sun and T-Rock stations and stuff like that, so.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, I would thank everybody for coming today, and especially welcome from the other world. And here we get a t-shirt from Nick.
Ooh.
Yeah. Like this. But you don't would like you don't like the back though.
So. Oh, I'm very happy about the Free Software Foundation.
Yeah.
I still support free software from the FSF side and the GNU side. I like the GPL. The only problem was I actually distributed my software, Tor, under the GPL,
yeah.
And then I realized that there were people who couldn't use it. That's not free. So it just depends. I mean, I was a GPL guy until I was a software author.
Okay.
And now I'm a BSD guy. So
who couldn't use it?
People who wanted to incorporate my code in their code without changing their license. People who wanted to link OpenSSL without breaking the OpenSSL license, and so on. So, yes, I'd be happy to talk about licenses as well. I mean, opinions about those. So,
yeah.
Great, thank you.
Yeah.
I'm not sure quite what I was expecting to see on the back of the t-shirt.
No.
No, I use stuff that's BSD, and I use stuff that's GPL, it's all fine. As long as it's some sort of Debian free software, I'm happy with it.